okay. Well, the room's thinned out a bit. Are we back? Oh, we are. All right. We are back on the record. And at this time, Ms. Jacobson, who is your next witness?
Mike Silva. And I believe he's ready to go.
Okay. All right. Were you here earlier and when I swore everyone in?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Silva, proceed.
Can you please state your name and occupation for the commission?
Michael Silva, S-I-L-V-A. I'm a research engineer and president of Intertech Consultants.
And what's your business address?
494 Salmar, S-A-L-M-A-R, Avenue, Campbell, California.
And can you please describe your involvement in the project?
Yes, I was asked by Basin Electric to perform two tasks related to the proposed transmission project. I was asked to evaluate the electric and magnetic field levels, or EMF levels, and I was asked to comment on the use of the global positioning system, or GPS, for agricultural or other operations near the proposed 345 kV transmission line.
Mr. Silva, I show you what's been marked as Exhibit 37. Judge, is that the correct number?
No, hold on one second. 36.
36. Could you identify what Exhibit 36 is, Mr. Silva?
Yes, that's the testimony that I prepared.
Your Honor, I'd move into evidence Exhibit 36.
Any objection, Mr. Armstrong?
No objection.
Exhibit 36 is admitted.
Mr. Silva, did you prepare a report with your findings?
Yes.
And can you please describe the findings in your report?
Yes, I've prepared a report on the calculated EMF levels, and it's contained in the tables within the report. I found that there was nothing unusual or different about the EMF levels from the proposed 345 kV project. The calculated EMF levels are similar to, and generally lower, than other transmission lines of this voltage class that have been in service since the 1950s.
Mr. Silva, earlier you discussed that part of your work with the project involved some research and a report on GPS issues. Can you discuss your conclusion related to that?
Yes. Based on the theoretical work I did and some practical measurements that I performed under transmission lines, including, in one case, 4 345 kV lines at a single location, in which I evaluated the performance of GPS receivers under these lines. I believe that GPS will be able to receive the satellite signals from near and under the proposed transmission line. And this is also borne out by the fact that cell phone companies in the United States and Canada commonly mount cell phone antennas, base stations on power line towers, and the cell phone companies also mount GPS antennas that they use for highly accurate timing directly onto high voltage transmission lines, including 345 kV lines. And this further supports my conclusion that it would be unlikely that the 345 kV line would interfere with use of GPS.
No further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Jacobson. Mr. Armstrong, any questions?
In your studies, did you conclude there would be any adverse effects either as a result of EMF or to the GPS functioning as a result of this line?
No, I did not believe there would be an effect.
No further questions.
Thank you. Mr. Lean.
Just a quick one. You said that the EMF was probably lower on this project than others. Is that due to conductor configuration or height from the ground, or what is that?
That's very good. It's both of those. Primarily due to the way the wires are configured in a triangular shape, and a little bit because there's extra ground clearance than the minimum required by the National Electric Safety Code.
Okay, thanks.
You do know he is an electrical engineer.
Aha. No, I did. Now I know.
All right. Thank you. Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mike, for being here today. Have you testified in front of this commission before?
Once before, Your Honor.
For which hearing was it? It was Minn Kota, wasn't it?
Yes, Commissioner, it was Minn Kota.
Fair enough. And the when you look at the what you did in that line to what you did in this line, you said this line actually has less than the other lines you look at, or just less generally?
Well, it depends on which lines you compare it to, but generally, as 345 lines are often built, this line generally has lower EMF.
All right. And then tell me how you take a conceptual study then to something you might do in the ground that confirms that study.
For EMF or for the GPS work?
Both of them, actually.
Okay, well, for the GPS, I'll do first. My co-author on this work was a professor from Washington State University. We did a theoretical analysis of what's called scattering. The GPS satellites are in space about 12,000 miles away. And so you receive the signals at the receiver. And so you can do calculations if an object is between you and the satellite, how much scattering occurs of those microwave signals. I would not have thought there would be much scattering, which means you lose some of the signal strength. Just as a rule of thumb, if the object, such as, say, a transmission line wire, is much smaller than the wavelength of the signal, there's not going to be much of an effect. So our calculations confirm there would be 3 to 4% scattering, which is none. It's non-existent. So what I did in terms of the practical, I obtained at the time the highest quality precision ag and precision aviation GPS receiver made by Trimble and some other companies. And I went to several locations in the United States where there were 345 and 500 kV power lines. And I would start several hundred feet away from the line, recording the strength of the signals I received from, in this case, five different satellites. And so I was logging the signal strength every second. And in my testimony, there's a graph of that as I started approaching the line. So what you're looking for to see, does the strength of the received signal drop off? And I drove under the power lines all the way through and didn't see a drop off. However, when I drove under some trees with really dense foliage, I did see in my exhibit, you can see that one of the satellites, you can see the signal starting to tail off just a little bit because of the foliage. I also did this in the rain and other types of power lines in other states, and never did I see any influence on the received signal. In addition, I plotted your position on a graph. You can take the longitude and latitude that your receiver's recording, and you can put it in a spreadsheet and plot it, and it should be a straight line. And so you can see if there's any departure from that, that you've got a positioning error introduced, and I didn't see a problem with that either.
Okay, thank you. And then just to put a finer point on it, if somewhere in our next 2 days of hearings, we have people, citizens come in and testify that they feel this power line will throw off their GPS and their tractors, you would not hold much merit to those comments?
Yes, I've investigated a couple of those complaints where people thought there was a GPS interference problem and they could see a power line off in the distance and they just assumed that was it. And in one case, it was walkie-talkies that were being used that was causing the interference. Another case, it was ignition system noise that was causing the interference.
But not the power line?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Silva.
Thank you. Commissioner Christman?
So the people that complain of this, you think, are either reiterating something they heard or having some other issues, like the ignition system issues that you mentioned?
They're probably having some other issues. I did mention that you could lose one satellite if you drove really close to one of the lattice-type towers. But since you're tracking usually several satellites, that shouldn't have much of an effect. This line, that would be even less likely because they're using these single steel poles and not a 30-foot wide or 25-foot wide steel tower. The people that make this equipment, I've dealt with them, particularly with Trimble, with some of their research people. They know where their equipment's going to be used. They know it's going to be used in agriculture, and they know it's going to be used under power lines. And they do test it under power lines. The GPS signal itself is a spread spectrum signal, and so it's more robust in resisting noise or interference, for example, from power lines. I haven't found any credible or published incident of a power line causing interference in that way. If you had a handheld GPS unit and you went and stood inside of one of those large lattice towers that the commissioner said looked like a steel man or something, yeah, you could block the signals inside of that if you were standing inside of the tower or something. But just by driving by a tower, you shouldn't be losing the lock of your positioning accuracy.
But so to the extent there is something, it's the tower and not the wires or any electromagnetic fields or anything. It's the physical tower that does that with a handheld?
A very large tower could do it with a handheld if you're right against it. The electromagnetic fields from a power line are generally the largest ones at 60 cycles per second. So to have interference, you need something that's causing a microwave type of interference, which is billion cycles. GPS operates at one, or the civilian signal operates at approximately 1.5 billion cycles per second. The military signal operates at approximately 1.2 billion cycles per second. Power lines operate at 60 hertz or 60 cycles per second, and they're not really generating EMF in that frequency band. When I found interference with either the walkie-talkie or with ignition system, the ignition system is gap-type noise, sparking, and it can have, you know, fairly broad band. It was a harmonic of the walkie-talkie. And in my testimony, there are some military radars, some FM radio stations, and other things that are harmonics, which is a multiple of the main frequency, can approach the GPS frequency. Cell phones operate at either about 900 million cycles per second or 1.9 million cycles per second. They're small microwave radios too. And my point in my testimony is the cell phone companies are mounting antennas on some companies' towers in the U.S. and Canada. Cell phone companies also use GPS themselves. The main system in the United States, in Europe, is called GSM, and it is you're assigned time slots. When you talk on a cell phone, you're assigned time slots, and so you need very precise timing signals. And so the cell phone companies use GPS, not for positioning, but for the atomic clocks that are on each of those satellites. Each satellite has four atomic clocks. And so the cell phone companies get their time signal, as do power companies. The power companies time their frequency, their 60 hertz, and some of their switching and other operations using GPS. But one of my points is that the cell phone companies themselves are putting GPS antennas on the sides of towers, on the legs of towers, and sometimes at the top of towers. And they wouldn't be doing it if there was an interference problem.
I have nothing further, Your Honor.
Thank you, Commissioner. Commissioner Fedorchik.
No questions. Thank you.
Any further questions for this witness? Thank you. Ms. Jacobson, what was Exhibit 36?
36 is the testimony of Mike Silva.
Okay. Let's label that 37. I'm going to back up just a moment and clarify something for the record. Mary Sand handed me the statement of Susan Weigel Dickey. She attached to that was a statement of the Killdeer Mountain Alliance. And the Killdeer Mountain Alliance, Rob Sand and Lori Jepson were here and testified. And this is their statement. So I'm going to admit their statement, their testimony, into the record as Exhibit 36, since they were here and presented testimony. The statement of Susan Weigel Dickey, who was not here to testify, will be placed into the public input file of the commission, and the commission can give whatever weight it believes the statement should get when you make your decision. Does that make sense to everyone? All right, so the statement of the Killdeer Mountain Alliance, their testimony is Exhibit 36, and then Exhibit 37 will be Mr. Silva's testimony, statement of his testimony. All right, thank you. It's getting late, sorry. Please proceed.
Your Honor, the next witness is Dr. Peter Wahlberg. Dr. Wahlberg, can you please state your name and occupation?
Yes, my name is Peter Wahlberg. That's spelled V as in Victor, A-L-B-E-R-G. And I'm an environmental health consultant with Gradient, which is a company that does human health risk assessment in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
And what is your business address?
The business address is 20 University Road, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
And can you just summarize briefly your educational experience?
I have a graduate degree in both physics and human physiology. I went to the physics department at Harvard University to get my PhD degree in physics, and then I followed that up with additional training at the Harvard University School of Public Health, where I got a degree in human physiology. And subsequent to that time, I did research in a combination of human physiology and physics, and that essentially prepared me to understand a great number of things about how the human body might interact with electric and magnetic fields. I was at Harvard University until about 1990, and since that time I've been a consultant at Gradient working on human health risk assessment, and one of my areas is the area of ionizing and non-ionizing radiation and how that exposure might affect your health.
And Dr. Wahlberg, what's been your involvement in the project?
I was asked by Basin Electric to take a look at EMF generally and be prepared to explain how research in this area has progressed and what is currently known about applicable standards and guidelines for power line EMF exposure and how those might relate to the kinds of values that we have in Mike Silva's report on the EMF impact of these particular lines.
Dr. Wahlberg, I'm showing you what's been marked as Exhibit 38, and could you please identify it?
Yes, this is the written testimony that was prepared to present before this board and the commissioners, and it was prepared by myself to explain EMF health effects.
Your Honor, I move for admission of Exhibit 38.
Any objection?
No objection.
Exhibit 38 is admitted.
Dr. Wahlberg, in your professional opinion, are there any adverse health effects to be expected due to EMF exposure from the project?
Well, to make a long story short, the answer is no. The actual line of reasoning is explained in the written testimony, and it relates to the fact that the kinds of exposures to power line EMF that you have in this situation are not established to have health effects. And in fact, if you compare the levels of exposure that you would get either at the right-of-way or even under the lines at the point of maximum exposure, they are below those standards that have been developed by international agencies for continuous public exposure without expectation of adverse effects.
Your Honor, no further questions.
Thank you. Mr. Armstrong.
No questions.
Mr. Lean. We'll go to the commission. Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor. Dr. Volberg, it seems like such a waste that we have a guy here from Harvard and we're not going to ask you a bunch of questions.
Well, that's why if anything is bothering you, I'm happy to try to address it.
Thank you. I keep saying this, a human face on it. So in your research and your experience, someone standing under this 345 kV line 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, would that have a negative effect on them?
In my analysis of the relevant science and the kind of public health opinions that are out there, the answer is no. They would not have an effect.
So there, in your opinion, there's no scenario that this could endanger human health? That'd be the extreme level, I would think, unless they fall off a pole or something, but that's not the EMF's problem.
Well, that's not quite the case. I think one of the things that you can see in my report and the exhibits attached to it is that electric and magnetic fields are produced by any kind of electrical wiring or electrical appliances. And in the literature and, in fact, in reports from the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, you have tabulations of magnetic fields, for example, produced by motors and, you know, shavers and all sorts of appliances that people use on an everyday basis. And those levels are, in fact, higher or can be higher than what you would experience under the line. Now, they aren't continuous. They are intermittent. But to the extent that we have no evidence that either intermittent or continuous magnetic field exposure results in adverse health effects, I would say that, yes, both of those things kind of support each other, combined with the fact that the society as a whole has been using power line EMF frequencies for over 100 years now. And we don't have any patterns of disease in national health statistics that would suggest that that type of exposure is causing an increased risk of disease.
Okay, is the research that you've had on humans, can you extrapolate that over to animals to where if someone in the next two hearings comes in and says, my cattle grazing underneath this is going to harm my cattle, it'll harm their effects to reproduce. Would you be able to offer any insight on those potential scenarios that might come up?
Yes, I would. And I think that the point you make is a very good one, that in fact, a lot of the laboratory work that was funded by the United States Congress and was essentially handed out to researchers by the National Institutes of Health was to do work on laboratory animals to see whether or not exposures to electric and magnetic fields could cause adverse effects in a system where you could very closely control the exposure and you could also do very careful experiments to see if any cells, tissues, organs had been affected. The reason they did those were primarily because those results were relevant to what we might expect in humans. And in fact, the same kind of logic applies to those experiments and their relevance to farm animals. And those experiments did not show effects, for example, on animal behavior or reproductive capability that you would say, well, that might have occurred in farm animals. So I think that you're right, that those negative results in the laboratory animal experiments can be extrapolated. Furthermore, there have been real experiments with farm animals that have actually been housed underneath transmission lines. I think many of these were done by the Bonneville Power Administration, and they also showed a lack of effect. Now, science can never prove a total negative, but I think what we have here in terms of the weight of evidence is that it doesn't support the establishment of standards that would be protective of either animal health and behavior or human health and behavior, because the few positive results are just not consistent.
I have to ask the flip side of the question. You're obviously an expert in your field. Would I be able to find an expert in the field that would completely contradict what you're telling me today?
EMF continues to, partly to my amazement, it continues to be a controversial issue. And so if you were to go to the internet and type in, you know, magnetic field, power lines, health effects, and so forth, I think you would call up thousands of sites, many of which would say, yes, there are effects. And I think what these sites are saying, essentially, that in the very broad spectrum of scientific literature that you have on EMF research, there are some studies that show certain positive effects. They're not very reproducible, and they don't seem to paint a very coherent picture, but you can pick them up. They're not, it's not that all the studies are negative. But my position is that this is just the nature of science, is that you're always going to have some positive effects, and you have to have replication. You have to have some sort of consistent mechanism that gives you those effects before public health agencies will take note of them. So the short answer to your question is yes, you could find people who...
People, not necessarily the experience and level that you'd bring to the table.
Well, I mean, some of these people publish in areas of EMF, so I think you can find people who have... You know, I would say reasonable credibility, but I disagree with their opinion. And I think partly I'm also comparing EMF to other areas of health risk assessment that I'm very familiar with to say, yes, we cannot completely rule out that there is a zero risk, but compared to all of the other places where we can put our time, energy, and resources to improve our health and so on, I think there is pretty uniform agreement that the effect of powerline EMF is way down in terms of a priority.
There's no regulation of EMF by the, here we go, acronyms, by the EPA or any other body such as that, is there?
No, there are no regulations in the United States, and even the international guidelines are health guidelines. They're not enforceable standards.
So could we assume that since there's nothing, let me rephrase that. It's my perception that if there is an agreement of science, the EPA will find a way to regulate it. The fact that the EPA and other agencies have not found a way to regulate this shows me there's really no science that can back any kind of regulation behind it.
And yes, I would tend to agree with that, that regulators want to regulate, and that in fact, if they found credible science on which they could develop a standard, I think they would. So rather than saying that the lack of regulation is alarming, I would say in fact, the lack of regulation is reassuring that no hazard of real note has been identified.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Chrisman.
Your Honor, I enjoyed this, but I don't have a single question.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchik?
Yes. So do these have electromagnetic fields?
Yes, your cell phone has electromagnetic fields, but as Mike Silva pointed out, those are a much different frequency. So those cell phones operate up in the gigahertz, namely either 0.9 or 1.9 gigahertz, which is a billion cycles per second, a much different frequency than 60 cycles per second.
You're talking exposure. How does it compare to power line exposure? Somebody who's talking on this on fairly, or holding it, or having it at their bed, or sitting by it most of the day. That I do that, really.
For radio frequency fields, there are standards. The Federal Communications Commission, and in fact, international agencies also set standards for what the exposure is allowable for. Public exposure and worker exposure, and cell phones and cell phone base stations fall below those levels. So yes, if you're on the cell phone, you're getting some of the now called non-ionizing radio waves that are being absorbed by your body, but again, the level is low enough. I mean, the basic principle in all of toxicology is that the dose makes the poison. So the exposure in terms of actual electromagnetic energy that's absorbed from a cell phone is vastly larger than from power lines. Not only are the power line fields very weak, but they're very poorly absorbed by the body. They essentially go right through you, which to me is good news. I mean, nothing is absorbed. But for a cell phone, some of the energy is actually absorbed. The amount is very small, and that's the amount that's being regulated by the exposure standards.
Just to make sure I understood you, did you say the exposure and the amount absorbed from cell phone use would be much greater than what you would have from the electrical wires?
Yes, if you were to express the exposure in terms of watts of energy, how many watts of energy am I absorbing from my cell phone versus how many watts of energy am I absorbing for this nearby power line? The answer is correct. Yes, the watts of energy would be much higher for the cell phone.
Okay. And I want to make sure I understand, too. Are there or are there not standards for how far houses should be located from these wires and that sort of thing?
There are no regulatory standards as to how far your houses should be located. There was a period of time when in the state of California they had some guidelines as to how far they wanted school buildings and so forth from power lines, but those were really more a matter of policy. They really were not based on a particular level creating a hazard versus some other distance not causing a hazard.
Okay. And the same for the international health guidelines. You mentioned that. What are those and who set them and who follows them?
Well, the main commission there is the International Commission on Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection, and that acronym is ICNIRP, if you take the first letter of each of those words. And they have been around for a long time, and they are a independent body. They're not really a governmental body, but they're a body of independent scientists who get together and look at the scientific literature periodically and try to determine what the standards are, not only for power line frequencies, but for other frequencies as well. And they reviewed back in a time period when the EMF controversy was perhaps more intense for power lines. They reviewed it in 1998. It was the standard they set at that point was 833 milligauss was the 60 hertz standard. That was a 24/7 continuous exposure, not expected to cause any adverse health effects. In 2010, that same body re-reviewed the literature, again looked at all the stuff that had come out since their previous decision, and interestingly enough, they actually increased the allowable exposure to 2,000 milligauss, and they said that this was now their public standard for 24/7 exposure. So I think there are people who are concerned about it. As I said, it's in the internet. You may in fact get people who are worried about the EMF, but I think what you need to do is to look at, first of all, legitimate agencies and so forth, and then secondly, look at what are the actual guidelines that they suggest, and the fact that these agencies look at the science as it comes out. If something came out that was really established and alarming, they would incorporate that into their reasoning.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Any other questions from the commissioners? All right, any further questions from council? Mr. Lean? Thank you. Sorry it's late. I have to check my cheat sheet here. Thank you, Dr. Valberg.
You're welcome.
All right, Ms. Jacobson, I believe you wanted to call a rebuttal witness.
Yes, that's correct. The witness is Dr. Kimball Banks.
Dr. Banks, did you take the oath previously?
Yes, I did.
All right, thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Jacobson.
Dr. Banks, could you please state your name and occupation?
My name is Kimball Banks, KimballBanks. I'm regional manager for Metcalf Archaeological Consultants. The address is 510 Airport Boulevard, Suite C, Bismarck.
Can you give the commission a short history of your employment history and work experience?
Since 2009, I've been the regional manager in Metcalf's Bismarck office. Before that, I've had a total of about 35 years of involvement in various stages or various aspects of cultural resource management, 26 of which were in federal service, first with the Bureau of Indian Affairs and then with the Bureau of Reclamation. Prior to that, I worked for the Colorado River Tribes, the Navajo Tribe, and I ran the Cultural Resource Management Program at New Mexico State University.
And what's your involvement with the project?
Basin contracted with my company to conduct the cultural resource inventories for compliance with NEPA and other applicable federal and state cultural resource legislation.
Dr. Banks, there's been a lot of testimony today about the various types of cultural surveys that have been performed on the project. And can you please discuss how Metcalf went about their Class 1 literature research?
Okay. The State Historical Society has guidelines for conducting cultural resource surveys within the state. The first step is to conduct what they call a Class 1 site and manuscript file search. In other words, what we do is we go up and search the site files at the Historical Society for all known sites within the project area. Those are all recorded sites. And then we also search the manuscripts to identify any survey, cultural resource surveys that have been taken place within the project area. The objective of that is to provide Basin with an idea of what, you know, what is the likelihood they are going to encounter cultural resources, either historic, architectural, or archaeological, within their project area. And if, you know, the extent to which their areas have been subjected to cultural resource surveys. The site files are all those sites that have been recorded in the state of North Dakota and are on file there.
Dr. Banks, earlier you stated that the State Historical Society has guidelines for doing these Class 1 surveys. Did you follow those guidelines in your work for Basin Electric?
Yes, we did.
Was there anything indicated about the Kildare Mountain Battlefield in the Class 1 research or surveys that you did?
The only indication the Kildare Battlefield was the state historic site, the 1 acre state historic site, and the site that the gentleman who lives there pointed out on the board. That was the only evidence or only recorded evidence for the Kildare Mountain Battlefield.
And what was the area of land that you did the Class 1 surveys on?
We did a 6 mile wide swath centered on the center line of the construction corridor.
And earlier, it was testified that the Class 3 surveys were done on all but 1/2 mile within the Kildare Mountain Battlefield. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And what did those Class 3 surveys, what did you find in those surveys in the Kildare Mountain Battlefield area?
Okay, first off, we inventoried a 150-foot wide construction corridor or easement. I would like to say that we obtained landowner permission before we go on their lands. If the landowner did not want us on their land, we would not go on their land, hence that half mile. We found one farmstead, one prehistoric artifact scatter, one multi-component site that had depression-era historic artifacts, and then some prehistoric materials, six prehistoric isolated artifacts, single artifacts. We also found what was originally a site lead, but we were not able to determine that that was actually there. And then we were not able to relocate two sites that were on file at the State Historical Society.
Was there anything related to the battle found in the Class 3 surveys that you
no.
or, okay. Does the Kildare Mountain Battlefield area have any federal or state protection or special legal status that you're aware of?
No. Right now, the Park Service, if you look at their report that's been mentioned before, they identified it as a potential area. That area is not set in stone. It's only there. It exists basically out in space. It's never been fully defined legally or any other way.
Are you familiar with the listing process for sites for the National Register of Historic Places?
Yes, I am.
And can you just tell the commission briefly how one goes about getting a site on that register?
Well, there are a number. It can be done any number of ways. An individual can start it. A conservation group, an NGO. The two I'm familiar with is one, it's instituted by the state itself, the State Historical Society. And then when I was in federal service, the agency I worked with started the process. It has to be done in conjunction with the SHPO. The SHPO has to have buy-in on it and approve it. They go through a review process and then they send it to the National Park Service for their review. And ultimately, if it is declared to be on the National Register, then it's filed with a keeper of the National Register, which is the Secretary of the Interior.
And what are some of the requirements in order to get a property listed on the register?
Okay.
Generally.
It has to be significant. I'm not going to get this totally right, but it has to be significant either in American history, prehistory, or architecture. It has to be what they call a district site, structure, object, or building. and it has to possess certain qualities of integrity, which include location, design, workmanship, materials, and there's two others. And then it has to meet one of four criteria to be eligible. And it either has to be associated with a significant event, a person important in either local, regional, or state or national history. It has to have architectural significance, or it has to be able to have a potential contribute information important to history and prehistory.
And what is the role of the landowner in this process?
The landowner has to approve the process. I will say that there's, in doing our surveys, if we come across a site and the SHPO agrees, we can identify that site as potentially eligible. That's afforded the same protections under the National Historic Preservation Act as if the site was actually listed on the register. But to be formally listed on the register, you have to have the landowner's approval on that. The whole process is not designed to affect any aspect of property. I mean, property rights are paramount.
And earlier it was discussed the additional survey work that Basin Electric will be doing. If anything is found related to any objects, what happens to those?
To the objects themselves?
Yes.
They belong to the landowner. If the landowner, we would return them to the landowner, and if the landowner did not want them or agreed to, then they would be curated at the State Historical Society.
Earlier, there was testimony regarding involvement of Native American tribes. And can you just discuss briefly from your involvement as the archaeologist to the project on how the tribes were involved from a cultural resource perspective?
Okay. I was not involved directly with any Native American consultations. That's WAPA's Western's responsibility, but as I understand it, they sent out letters to a number of tribes within the project area, or around the project area, and I believe that's included in the EIS. As I understand it, the only response they got was from the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, and as I understand it, Basin has been in negotiations with them as to, what they want out of the deal.
What's the status of the Class 3 surveys?
The Class 3 surveys have been completed, except for those areas where we've not had access or where Basin is in the process of possibly changing the route or minor alterations.
So earlier you discussed an interim report. What's the significance of that report in relation to the whole approval process from SHPO?
The interim report was produced primarily so that Western could enter into consultations with the tribes. They provide tribes with the copies of that report along with, the environmental impact statement as well.
No further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Armstrong?
Thank you. Point of clarification, Mr. Banks, you mentioned something about a site being potentially eligible. Could you expound on that a little bit?
Under the National Historic Preservation Act, which is the primary act governing cultural resources, if a federal agency and the state agree to it, they can agree that a site is potentially eligible. They don't have to go through the whole nomination process because that takes time. Generally, in my experience, it's taken at least 2 years. But if the federal and the state agency agree that it's potentially eligible, it's afforded the same protections, and I use that term loosely, under the National Historic Preservation Act as a site that is already listed. I might add that by protection, I don't mean that site is preserved or for anything, or that you cannot do construction within that site boundaries, but you have to follow the process. I mean, all the National Historic Preservation Act is a process. It doesn't stop development. It's not set to stop development or anything like that. It's just a process to get public involvement and to either protect that site either physically in space or abstract the data out of that site represents.
So when you're conducting a cultural resources inventory and developing the report that goes along with it, do you typically recommend mitigative measures, avoidance measures with cultural sites that are located. That's correct, isn't it?
I would say more often than not, it's avoidance measures, primarily because clients such as Basin do not want to take the time that would take to actually go through the whole process of you know, declaring a site potentially eligible and then have to go through a whole mitigation process to offset any impacts to that site from construction.
So they typically avoid it, right. Or if for some reason it can't be, then you would recommend mitigation?
To the extent, yeah. But you'd have to develop a mitigation plan. It would have to be approved by the state and the federal agency, and then you'd have to go through and implement that mitigation plan before construction could take place.
And then that's a recommendation you make. The company typically agrees to it. Then you submit the plan to the state office.
And in this case, it would be Western.
Okay. So Western would...
Western then would consult with the SHPO to see if that plan is adequate, acceptable, and probably with Native American tribes as well. And then if it was, then we go out and carry out that plan.
Well, usually where it ends is after the Class 3 and the whole corridor route has been surveyed, there becomes a recommendation that no historic properties are affected. And State Historic Preservation Office would concur in that.
Right.
This project obviously has not been completed all along the proposed route.
That's correct.
I understand that there has been Class 3 surveys of, I believe the number was approximately 70%.
Right.
And are you familiar with the results of the Class 3 surveys that have been conducted?
We've recorded 107, I think around 170 sites, and about 30 of those had been sites that had been previously recorded, and we went back and relocated them.
Are there any sites on this project that cause, that Basin has not either avoided or, are there any that they have not avoided, I guess, that you're aware of?
There are some that they have not avoided. We are going back in to evaluate the significance on that, and I believe that there's one that they cannot avoid that has been declared potentially eligible, and that will be mitigated. The mitigation will be limited to where the actual pole is going to be sited on that site.
So do you know what site that is or what it involves?
Not off the top of my head.
Do you know where it's at around the project area?
Again, not off the top of my head.
I believe I've seen you sitting through all of the testimony today. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And I presume you've listened to the discussion on the battlefield area. Mm-hmm. What, if anything, do you propose to be done there? I mean,
if that battlefield had, as mapped out, had been included in the file searches, we would have recommended that Basin avoid it just because of what you've heard today. It was not. Again, it has not been declared. It's not been declared eligible. It's not on the National Register. So right now it is. There's nothing stopping development on that, across that site. If the state and Western decided that it agreed that it was potentially eligible, then they would have to take steps to mitigate any impacts.
You've probably heard the discussion about removing the Gumbo Creek substation, the visual effects assessment, the magnetometer, and the detailed investigation at the sites of the poles. Do you have an opinion of whether those are reasonable measures to avoid unnecessary impact to the area, wherever it may fall on the legal spectrum?
I'm going to waffle on that and say that's the state has agreed to that. Okay. Now, whether I personally agree to that is my own personal opinion, but the state has agreed that that's, acceptable.
Is part of your analysis when you're doing these Class 3s or anything like that, kind of determining where they fall on exclusion avoidance areas such as that, do you get into that with the
No.
services criteria or the No. commission's criteria?
Because as I understand it, the commission's criteria don't apply to cultural resources per se.
What do you mean by that?
Well, my understanding of a exclusionary is applies more to natural features like wetlands and things like that.
You testified about being familiar with the process on getting something registered. Do you think, in your experience, if you know, does having a power line in this area, would that somehow affect whether it could be a registered area?
I personally don't think it would. I don't know. I can't think of any site on the National Register. Well, I won't go quite that far. Most sites on the National Register have had some developments post when they were occupied or used. For instance, somebody here earlier today said Gettysburg and their transmission lines going through there, but that's still, I don't know if that's on the register, but it is a nationally recognized, probably a national historic landmark, but they've had developments on it. The state just nominated or agreed to push forward the nomination for the Whitestone Battlefield in the eastern part of the state, which is also associated with the Minnesota Uprising. And it's got modern farm developments, or farmhouses in that area. So there's nothing, you don't have to have the point is you don't have to have a pristine site for it to be on the on the register. I think the best way to couch it is there comes a tipping point where, there's too much development in a situation like this. I don't know what that tipping point would be.
And even if it were, is my understanding correct from the testimony that it still wouldn't prevent any of the private landowners in the area from doing whatever they want?
There's nothing to prevent private landowners from doing what they want. This is, that's one of the misconceptions I deal with all the time. This is not a law of taking. Property rights prevail, period.
That's all the questions I have.
Mr. Lean?
I have no questions.
All right, thank you. Commissioner Kalk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Dr. Banks, for your testimony and your patience today. So just a couple, Mitch did a great job of getting all the questions I think I had out there. But you said private landowners, it's their property. So at the end of the day, if Basin had easements to go across all the area that's contentious today, they could just build it with our approval. I mean, if they already have the easements, all this process becomes irrelevant?
Well, they could build it, provided Western had complied with NEPA and the National Historic Preservation Act. Both those acts are all they are processes.
Right.
To and the objective is to get public input on the effects.
Because that was my experience with NEPA as well. It was a process. At the end of the day, there was an outcome, and I remember many times there'd be no alternative other than the one we had, and you'd have reburial taking place of I mean, it was important stuff, but we would deal with the cultural things as they came. So in your experience, seeing how this plays out, the NEPA documents, how do you think the interplay between the SHPO's action and the NEPA decision will play itself out? I know you can't predict the future, but you've got experience in a lot more of this area than I have.
You mean in terms of the battlefield itself?
Of the process. Do you think that the... Is it? You can't predict, but the federal agencies that are working through this, they'll have to make a decision to either go somewhere else and start the process again, or push through. Do you have any insight on to what that would be? If you were recommending, you will be recommending to Basin at some point, I'm sure, what to do there. Not today.
I'm going to recommend. Obviously, like I say, the SHPO has provided a letter. With their recommendations. I suspect that Western will agree to those recommendations. And if that's the case and both parties agree, then there's nothing to construct or to stop Basin from constructing that power line.
So the SHPO has a recommendation, Western agrees, the record of decision sees nothing in it perhaps to contradict that. They sign the ROD, they move forward.
I would say that's I'm not taking into account any Native American concerns that may arise. That I can't predict. I gave up predicting that one a long time ago.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Christman.
Sir, which is the half mile that didn't get surveyed?
I forget the property. It was next to the gentleman, the first gentleman that testified in, the landowner here that testified in support of the project, I believe.
Commissioner Crisman, I believe it's section 2, Gary and Earl Whitehall, that half mile.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Fedorchuk?
So, summarize for us your thoughts on the conclusion that Tom Ezern and Aaron Barth had, that the study documents on which the proposals are based are unacceptably deficient.
I disagree. When we do a file search, we don't write histories. I mean, we prepare planning documents. And what clients need, like BASE need, they need to know physically what is out there. The history stuff is not our milieu. They want to know what is physically out there so that they can plan a route, you know, so they can plan their route and anticipate what, you know, possible problems they might run into vis-a-vis cultural resource. And to do that, they need to know what's on the ground. The historical aspect is, you know, we will, when we prepare our final report, then we will incorporate the historical aspect and put it in a larger context, you know, both archaeologically and historical. You know, our interim report is basically just a summary of what we've done and what we've found so far. But our final report will then put it in a larger context.
And did you walk this part? I mean, did you do a ground survey through this area of the corridor?
My staff, through the entire 8 miles?
Through the battlefield area?
I did not, but my staff did.
Your staff did?
Yes.
But for the half mile that...
Except for the half mile, because we did not have permission.
Okay. And I apologize if you've already described what you found there, but did you find artifacts from the battle?
None of them were... We found both historic and prehistoric. None of them were associated with the battle.
Okay. And my final question is, what time period is prehistory?
Yesterday.
That does not seem possible to me. That's all my questions.
Some of my staff say I'm prehistoric, so.
I want to live in the prehistory time.
Yeah, well, I'm a lot older than most of my staff, so. Prehistory is defined primarily, I guess you could call it, before written history. In this country, it starts about 1780 when the first Europeans appeared. Mm. So anything before that is prehistoric, is that area where we don't have any written records,
okay,
basically.
Thank you.
Commissioner Crisman?
As an expert in cultural and historic issues, did it concern you today when you heard one of the key players in the study that the government is funding already have his mind made up what the results of the study were and proclaimed that one side was on a mission of genocide?
Okay. As way of background, I was involved in the preparation of the National Historic, the nomination of the Whitestone Battlefield, which has preceded this one. I think that the whole Minnesota Uprising, when I look at that historically, it affected military policy towards Native Americans in the Northern Plains up until 1890 in the massacre at Wounded Knee. It set the stage for that. And you could extrapolate, essentially, and say that it actually affected, you know, it was basically a scorched earth policy. And you could say that the Sherman took that lesson and applied it in his march to Georgia. Now, that's speculation on my part. One of these days, I've thought about researching that when I have the time, which I doubt I ever will. But in a larger context, you know, it's a very important site. You know, I won't deny that. My problem is that the boundaries of that site have not been fully identified yet, which poses a big problem as far as development goes in that area. It may be that that is the boundary. I don't know. I've worked with military records enough to know that from that era that it's very difficult to define exactly what the boundaries of those battles are, because when they recorded, you know, the military kept detailed records, but what they were keeping detailed records were events, on the events, not locations. And it's very difficult from their records to extrapolate exactly where certain actions took place.
Thank you.
Any further questions from the commission? Any further questions from council?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Armstrong?
No, Your Honor.
Well, I'll say thank you for letting me be the cleanup batter, so.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other witnesses, Ms. Jacobson?
No, Your Honor.
All right.
So the last three witnesses that testified, we won't have, this is the last opportunity to talk to them, or will they be with us? Who'll be with us the next 2 days?
The last three that testified will only be here today.
Okay, so this is our chance to talk with them.
Okay, perfect.
Did you want to recall anyone, Commissioner Kolk?
No, I didn't, but that was why I think some of the questions I put out there is in anticipation of them not being able to rebut it. So if there's something that comes up that these witnesses would like to, that you'd like them to come back to it, you'll have to deal with that on your own, I guess.
Well, right, and if it does come up tomorrow, we can probably have them arrange to be in Williston for the next week.
Thank you.
All right. Is there any other matter that council, either of you, wish to bring to the attention of the commission?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
There are two more hearings scheduled on this matter, one tomorrow in Tioga and one on September 12th in Williston. And so this hearing, I will very shortly close the hearing today, but that does not mean the record of this matter is closed because we have two more hearings to go. So if there is nothing further, last chance. All right, if there is nothing further today, then I'm going to close the hearing, noting the correct time is 8:44 p.m. Mountain Time, 9:44 p.m. Central Time. The hearing is closed. Thank you.